Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Student drinking has long been a worry at colleges and universities across the country. Of particular concern are those students who engage in what has been generally referred to as binge drinking, that is the deliberate and rapid consumption of large amounts of alcohol with the express purpose of becoming as drunk as possible, as fast as possible. The question, though, is just how widespread is this behavior, and what are administrators trying to do to change the culture of alcohol use on their campuses? This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about student drinking. And our guest is someone who is an experienced practitioner, trainer, program consultant in the area of alcohol and other drug services. His name is Robert Chapman. He is currently a clinical assistant professor of behavioral health counseling at Drexel University in Philadelphia. He's developed and implemented programs for both inpatient and intensive outpatient treatment of alcohol and other drug dependents. He has taught at a number of places, State University of New York, Binghamton, LaSalle, Temple, St. Joseph's Universities in Philadelphia, and Eastern College in St. David's, Pennsylvania, where he's worked teaching counselors and human service professionals as an adjunct member of all of those various faculties. He is past president of the New York State Council on Alcoholism. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. We always welcome people who are listening to call in with their questions, comments. The only thing we ask is that people are brief so that we can get as many callers as possible and keep things moving along. But, of course, anybody who's listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL or 9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, comments, you can give us a call. Professor Chapman, hello.
Good morning. How are you, David?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. I appreciate you being with us. I think that probably people have seen or read some of the statistics on student drinking, and that they are certainly worrisome. If you look at those numbers, they're worrisome. If you're a parent with a student in college, I imagine it gives you pause. Certainly if you're a college administrator, this is something that you think about. And perhaps people have seen some of these. And a lot of the numbers, sort of the benchmark studies have been done at Harvard University at their School of Public Health. The numbers are certainly very worrisome, as I said, particularly when it comes to this activity. And we'll talk about what we mean by this and whether, in fact, that's a useful term or not. But this activity called binge drinking. What do you think we could say reliably about, let's talk about alcohol use by students and try and take it apart. Maybe starting with this, let me ask you this question first. If we said, well, how many students, honestly, if we asked them, do you drink, would say no? What percentage of students actually don't use alcohol at all?
Well, that's a really important question to ask, and I need to qualify the response by suggesting that it depends to a certain extent upon what area of the country you're talking about, because we do know from survey research that's been done over the past 15 to 20 years that different areas of the country will have students who report the use of alcohol at different rates. But if we took a look at the typical college student in the United States, we realize that approximately 19 to 20% of collegians report that they have not had anything of an alcoholic nature to drink in the last year. So the simple answer to your question, if we use the previous year as a benchmark, would be about 19 to 20% of students.
All right. So that leaves us with about 80% who would have said, yes, in the last year, I have had an alcoholic beverage. But then one has to go on and say, okay, how do we unpack that and sort out students who are drinking at a light to moderate level, however we want to define that, and then those students that are really drinking in a problematic way, either because of the pattern of their drinking, it may not be so much the overall consumption, say an entire year, but it's the pattern of their drinking. How do we sort out you know, light, moderate from problematic?
Well, once again, that's an important question to ask, and to a certain extent that will be affected by the way in which the individual considering the information defines the word problematic. Mm-hmm. Historically, we have tended to look at frequency of consumption and number of drinks consumed on each occasion as being sort of the benchmark as to whether or not someone is engaging in problematic drinking, if you will. But there are some difficulties with that when you begin to consider the amount of time during which the drinks were consumed, the gender of the consumer, the weight of the individual, whether or not the individual is eaten or not, and a variety of other variables. Generally what we hear when you were referring to the term binge drinking a moment ago, generally what we hear rather consistently coming out of studies that are being done predominantly at the Harvard School of Public Health is that somewhere in the neighborhood of about 20 to 22% of students would report engaging in the consumption of five or more drinks if a male, a male, and four or more drinks if a female in an evening out at least twice in the previous 2 weeks. And if we consider having consumed that quantity or greater at least once in the previous 2 weeks, the number goes up to about 43% or 44%. So while we are looking at a sizable minority of students who are engaging in not only the consumption of alcohol, but the consumption of what Harvard School of Public Health has defined as a binge, it's still a minority number, meaning that the majority of students who choose to consume do so in a moderate fashion, moderate being defined as less than four drinks in an evening out for women, less than five drinks in an evening out for men. Mm-hmm.
Well, as you point out, trying to come up with a general sort of measure of problematic alcohol consumption is difficult, at least because, as you suggest, you have to look at the amount consumed and the period of time, but then you also have to look at the individual. A large male can consume a certain amount of alcohol, and depending on what period of time we're talking about, depending upon whether there's food along with it, it's going to be probably less than a problem, or his blood alcohol level will be lower than if, say, you're talking about a woman who is much smaller, who, say, has not had a lot to eat. No, her blood alcohol level is going to be higher. So that means that you're going to have to say, okay, what kind of person are we talking about? How big are they? The duration of consumption. You also have to ask other questions like, would they happen to be taking medications by prescription, over the counter? And it does get pretty complicated. So having said all that, then, do you think that this term, binge drinking, and the way that we have defined it, that's in a period of, I think it's what, a period of 2 hours, five or more drinks in a row for men and four or more for women, that actually is a useful term?
Well, I think it's become somewhat the benchmark that many people are familiar with. The simple answer, and this is my opinion, is that I'm not particularly happy with that as a term to refer to any kind of collegiate drinking. Once again, because it attempts to determine whether something is or is not in the area of being problematic simply based upon the number of drinks consumed in a certain amount of time. It clearly is something that's captured the attention of the public. And it clearly is something that individuals have rightfully become sort of called to arms, so to speak, with regards to as far as addressing collegiate drinking. But I think that terms like dangerous drinking or high-risk drinking might be more appropriate because they are not tied so much to numbers of drinks, but rather would be taking a look at sort of things such as blood alcohol. And sort of a benchmark that many clinicians such as myself use is what's referred to as sort of the 0-1-2-3 rule with regards to drinking. And this isn't just for college students. This would be for anyone. And that is that 0 stands for the fact that not drinking is always an option. 1 stands for one standard drink per hour. 2 stands for no more than 2 times per week, and 3 stands for no more than 3 drinks in an outing. And if someone who did choose to use alcohol was following sort of that pattern, the likelihood is that the chances of risk are going to be significantly lowered. Now, keep again in mind, we're not talking about following those rules if you're behind the wheel of a car or operating a chainsaw or taking some kind of central nervous system depressant medication, but those are some benchmarks. So the simple answer to your question is I'm rather concerned with the term binge, in that I think that it's sort of for somebody who is perhaps 40 years or older is going to remember sort of the Ray Milland Lost Weekend picture of what a binge is, when in actuality the literature that we're hearing reported in the media oftentimes are talking about, as you had just described, that it could be 4 or more drinks in a 2-hour period for a woman or 5 or more drinks for a male.
Well, this, again, I suppose that we're making fine distinctions here, but that's probably important. And it also might be the case that we're still, you can use those same kinds of parameters, and that yet there might be a big difference between someone who, say, you know, say over a period of 2 hours, drinks 4 glasses of wine.
Yes.
And, you know, now some people might say that was too much, and for some people that they would be intoxicated. Well, but then that's one thing. There's a difference between that and then someone who is engaging in some really organized competitive drinking where you might have, you know, knocked back that much alcohol in half an hour or in less, where the idea is to get this really rapid intoxication that can be, as we know, it can be extremely dangerous. It can be fatal, in fact. Then you wonder, well, how many people are really engaging in that kind of behavior, and not just maybe one time, and then, you know, you live to regret that and you stop, but how many people do that on a regular basis?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and I don't have an exact answer for that because, again, most of the survey research tends to sort of take a look at using the benchmarks of the 4 or more or 5 or more drinks that you were talking about. But clearly there are 2 areas where you tend to see that kind of drinking happening with some regularity. And once again, while it's the sort of the standard behavior of a minority of students, even as a minority of students, the problems that can be associated with that kind of drinking are legendary, and they're the kind that make the front page of the campus news or the local news station, television, radio, what have you. Those 2 kinds of drinking fall into one is a competitive category and the other is a social category. The competitive category are the things such as beer pong or other kinds of drinking-related games, and anyone who goes online can probably find hundreds, if not thousands, of links to everything from official rules to paraphernalia and materials that can be purchased or used, or how to construct a beer pong table or whatever the case may be. The more social aspect that results in this kind of high risk, very problematic, quick intoxication drinking is what is sometimes affectionately referred to as pre-gaming. This is where several students would get together at an apartment or at their residence hall room or whatever and quickly consume, as you're suggesting, perhaps 3 or 4 drinks in a half an hour, usually in the forms of shots of liquor. And as the name suggests, pre-gaming, it's in essence sort of priming the pump, so to speak, before going out. And whether this is a desire to show up already experiencing the effect of the alcohol consumed, or whether it's just sort of a way to inoculate against the long lines at the keg, the point still remains that it's the rapid consumption of alcohol. And as you had pointed out, this not only can be high risk as far as somebody who trips up the stairs and breaks his or her wrist or doesn't make it to class the next day. It can be the individual who falls off a balcony and dies or gets hit by a bus crossing the street. Or if consuming enough in a short enough period of time may actually expire as a result of classic alcohol poisoning. So your points are well taken. The only answer I don't have sort of a specific comment on is what percentage of our collegians may be engaging in that kind of behavior on a regular basis. I do know that it is a minority, but as I said, even as a minority, that kind of behavior is very likely to have the consumer come to the attention of the community, of the public, of the medical authorities, of the law enforcement community, things of this nature.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Robert Chapman. He is a clinical assistant professor of behavioral health counseling at Drexel University in Philadelphia and is an experienced practitioner, trainer, program consultant in the area of alcohol and drug services, has worked in this field for more than 30 years. We're talking about drinking on college campuses and by college students, and not necessarily just on the campus, but drinking behavior of college students today. Questions welcome. We have someone here who's ready to join in. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller's in Terre Haute, Indiana, on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. A very interesting show. I was in college 30 years ago in a fraternity, and I can tell you that it was pervasive. It was borderline out of control. The guys in the fraternity would take the vending machines inside the frat house, take out the pop, and put bottles of beer in there. And it was 24/7. It was a percentage that obviously abused it, but it was all around. And that leads me to my question. I was wondering for your guest if he would like to comment, how much of this can we lay at the foot of the industry itself? In other words, David had a guest on a few months ago. I forget the gentleman's name. But basically his point was the beer commercials now look to be gauged towards, 14, 15-year-old boys, where the industry, dirty little secret, they want to get the kids hooked. So by the time they do get in college, they already have them as a lifelong customer, so to speak. And I'm just wondering how much responsibility the industry should take for something like this. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right.
You have a very perceptive listener there. It's an excellent question. Actually, I would recommend any of your listeners who are particularly interested in this issue, the issue of the industry and its connection perhaps to some of the problems that we see not only in college but just in general around the consumption of alcohol, and in particular marketing to youth, to go to the Center for Alcohol Marketing and Youth, which is CAMY, CAMY.org, which is out of Georgetown University in Washington. And it's a very informative website, includes videos and information with regards to the risk. I think that there is a degree of responsibility that does indeed fall upon the alcohol industry, not in its production of the product. I am not a neo-prohibitionist. I am not opposed to the consumption of alcohol. As I mentioned earlier, even for those who may be consuming illegally in college by virtue of their age, the majority of those who choose to drink tend to do so in moderation. But when we take a look at the way in which alcohol is advertised, and in particular the way in which alcohol is oftentimes linked, sometimes obviously and sometimes very subtly, to high-risk behaviors, be they high-risk with regards to activities or high-risk with regards to sex, things of this nature, I think that there's a certain message that's inherent in many of the advertisements. And one of the things that I oftentimes would say when I'm sharing in public in some of my addresses is just asking, has anyone in the audience ever seen anything other than the sunniest day with the shiniest cars, with the best-looking males and females engaged in the most interesting activities when the intent was to sell alcohol, be that beer, wine, or distilled spirits? And generally, the purpose of advertising is to increase the likelihood that individuals are going to engage in purchasing whatever the product is that's being advertised. But to the extent that the activities, and probably the classic example of this is the old Anheuser-Busch Spuds McKenzie campaign, where that was eventually taken off of the as a means of selling beer, simply because of its appeal to individuals who might not be of legal age to purchase. So your caller has a really interesting question, and one suggestion I would have for your listeners is to simply ask those kinds of questions frequently when the opportunity presents, and to familiarize themselves with some of the research that's being done around this very issue. Alcohol industry has its own self-imposed guidelines, which many, such as myself, might look at as being a little bit on the liberal or the little bit on the lenient side as far as guidelines are concerned, but they exist nonetheless. However, there is question as to whether the industry is consistently following its own guidelines. So one of the things that listeners can do is to look for opportunities to simply suggest that the industry follow its own guidelines with regards to advertising to decrease the likelihood that individuals under the age of 21 are going to be purchasing and using alcoholic beverages.
You know, I think that some people might assume that individuals' attitudes toward alcohol are formed before they get to college, and I'm sure that it is the case that people who have engaged in binge drinking or high-risk drinking as high school students are more likely to do that when they get to college. I think, though, isn't it not true that actually a lot of people don't really start consuming alcohol on a regular or serious basis until they get to college?
Well, you know, that really is something of a misnomer. I think that there was a time when that was probably more true than it is today. Mm. Rarely do I see, for example, in almost 20 years of interviewing students who would be referred after getting into trouble for an alcohol violation on campus, rarely have I met a student who did not start drinking prior to arriving on campus. Now, that would perhaps be something that would be a couple of few times a year where they would consume alcohol, or it would be something where they were having two or three or four beers perhaps over the course of an evening out when they were in high school. But rarely does someone arrive on campus who has not sort of had the opportunity to decide what it is they like to drink, under what circumstances, and have some experience that comes as a result of having had that practice. What we see change is not so much the introduction to, but the means by which individuals consume that alcohol. So in particular, for the individual who leaves home and is residing on campus, away from perhaps the scrutinizing eye of mom or dad or guardian, there is perhaps this perception of being able to get it a little bit more freely or to use it a little bit more liberally. And so we'll see an increase perhaps in frequency or quantity consumed in college. I'm about 40 years out of college myself, undergraduate school, and I can remember drinking when I was an undergraduate. But I and most of my peers, the intent was not to go out and become so hammered, as the saying would go, that we couldn't remember the next day. Probably in the 60s and 70s, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15 to 20% perhaps of drinkers had the intention of going out and becoming so completely drunk that they could not remember the next day. Whereas we see percentages considerably higher of individuals whose intent now is to become, as they say, obliterated. Or to have so much to drink as to become completely intoxicated. And this is where we begin to see some of the risks coming in. It's not so much the consumption of alcohol, and as many people know, while a central nervous system depressant drug, alcohol in small quantities is a social lubricant in that individuals have a bit of an easier time, you know, striking up a conversation or dealing with their social angst, if you will, when they're going out, especially when they're new on campus and making new friends and what have you. But to the extent that my intent is to have three or four shots in my room before I go out and then go to a party where I pay $5 and get a red 16-ounce plastic cup at the door and drink from the keg as much as I want, and my intent is to get intoxicated, now we're looking at sort of the risks that are significantly expanded. Mm. So the high school drinker, I think, is pretty much the norm as far as students. And again, this is going to vary from section of the country to section of the country. But it's the change in pattern of drinking once they arrive on campus, I think, that's significant today.
Well, that's just, and I promise, I have other calls I will get to. Just my observation, having been now maybe about you know, 30 years or a little bit more than 30 years out of being an undergraduate. I guess I would say the same thing, that thinking back on my experience, this kind of drinking that we're talking about, I did not engage in it, and I didn't see people engaging in it. So that it seems to me that this kind of problematic drinking is something that, if not new, the scale of it seems to be, it seems to have increased in degree.
Correct. Yet, even though it has increased in degree, as you put it, it's important that your listeners realize that this proportion of the collegiate population still represents a minority of college students who choose to drink, most of whom choose to drink, even though it's illegal because they're not 21, in a fashion that is in the 2, 3, 4 beer in an evening out range.
Well, this then leads to the question, are we... In the way that, particularly the way that it's been covered in the media, and perhaps also the way that administrators are talking about it, are we overstating the problem? This is not to say that there's not a problem, that alcohol consumption by students it can be a problem, particularly at this level. But then the question still stands: are we somehow overstating? Are we saying? Or giving the impression that it is in fact worse, it's bad enough, but it is worse than it actually is?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. And I think if you took 10 people and threw that question out, you could come up with a variety of different opinions. Mine is, I think, yes, we are tending to sort of look at this in a somewhat myopic fashion. If we looked at the big picture, we certainly are looking at issues of concern, and it's for that reason that so many people such as myself are focused on trying to take a look at effective strategies to sort of change individual behavior on a one-on-one basis and group behavior when we start to take a look at prevention strategies in colleges and universities. But if we were to take a look at sort of the overall population, I think we would have a much more measured sort of understanding of this issue. And as a matter of fact, one of the issues that I think has not been looked at sufficiently is what are the protective factors, if you will, that influence the choices that those majority of students who choose to drink respond to so as to have 2, 3, 4 drinks over the course of an evening out, and what is it that has affected them, and what is it that we can perhaps do, not only in colleges and university, but also to sort of work with colleges and universities partnering with high schools to address this sort of issue of transitioning from high school into the college setting.
Well, we'll get on some other callers here just very quickly. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Robert Chapman. He is a clinical assistant professor of behavioral health counseling at Drexel University in Philadelphia. We have a number of callers, and we'll go next to someone here in Urbana where we are. This is line one.
Hi.
Hello. Yes.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I am a graduate student at the University of Iowa, and I live in Urbana when I'm not going to school there, so I've kind of had the opportunity to see the drinking scene on my campus at Iowa and the campus at Illinois. And what I found interesting is sort of this high intensity sort of cluster of drinking that happens, particularly at the University of Iowa. There's just like 20, 30 bars clustered right downtown, and it's just sort of, it becomes late, massive party, overwhelming scene that everybody thinks is the place to be. And I guess I'm just interested in sort of how the placement or how where people hang out kind of affects drinking, and that if you actually, you know, us grad students, when we want to get away from that, we move a little bit outside to places where more older people, I guess, or adults hang out, and we find that sort of integrating with different ages sort of helps the environment. But when you're downtown and it's just these, you know, underage 20, 21-year-old, it's crazy. It's not out of control, and it just kind of perpetuates itself. So if there was some kind of way to, I don't know, break up that high-intensity area of bars where no adults or no, you know, people with, I guess, just want to hang out and have a good time would go. and I'll take my question off the air.
Okay. Well, Dr. Chapman, what do you say about that?
I'm very impressed by your listeners. Very, very perceptive. There are several actually really important points that your caller just made. The first of those is sort of taking a look at this whole issue of concentration. And if I may refer to that as being environment, that's a significant factor that can influence the way individuals will actually choose to consume alcohol. And I think that anyone, if he or she takes a look at him or herself, assuming that the listener is uses alcohol on some occasion, will probably realize that the environment that the individual is in will influence the way in which that person drinks. And one of the things that I'll oftentimes say when I'm talking with students is, when is the last time that you opened up your backpack, took out a can of beer, and started drinking it in your math class? And they all look at me like I'm crazy, and the point is that they never do that. And the reason is that there are certain environments where we have come to recognize that it's inappropriate to consume alcohol. And in those areas where it is appropriate to consume alcohol, there are different environments where we will consume alcohol in different ways. So, for example, if you're out to dinner at a nice restaurant with several of your friends, you're going to consume wine or beer or whatever your drinks are in a different way than if you're going to a house party where you pay, as I said earlier, $5, you get a pint plastic cup at the door, and you can drink all night long from the keg. So environment, I think, is a significant factor. Now, one of the issues that becomes a challenge in certain downtown areas, if you will, or areas that cater to a collegiate population, is you're going to have a tremendous amount of competition between, you know, bar A, B, C, all the way through the alphabet. And consequently, each one is attempting to increase the likelihood that he or she is going to be able to get the requisite share of the drinking population. So you come up with oftentimes drink specials, and the focus of the drink special in and of itself actually, first of all, attracts a particular population. The person who wants to have two or three beers is not going to be attracted to the penny to your pee drink special, therefore you're going to have a higher risk drinking population that's coming in the door from the get-go. Second of all, you've got individuals who, by virtue of attempting to take advantage of that special, are going to try to consume as much as they can as quickly as they can in order to be able to take advantage of the happy hour or whatever that particular promotion happens to be. So you've got the environment, first of all. Second of all, you've got the competition that exists between those who are catering to that collegiate population. Thirdly, you have the mentality of the individual who's going in there. And probably, as all of your listeners can attest to, you put enough alcohol into enough people in a congested place, and you essentially are just sort of waiting for something to happen, and usually that something is less than positive. The third issue that the caller brings up, which I think is a very, very important one, is what can we do about this? And the whole issue of environment and the whole issue of alcohol outlet density, as it's referred to, is what's sometimes referred to as a public policy issue. And many times individuals, especially those who are not directly involved with the college community, although may live sort of on the, you know, contiguous to the campus or somehow come into contact with the campus, wonder, what can I do or what can we do? One of the most effective environmental management strategies that has been devised and has been shown to be effective over the past years are campus community coalitions. This is where you would have members of the campus community, staff, faculty, administrators, and students, collaborating with members of the community. This can be residents, it can be business, it can be from the police department, it can be from, you know, the Tavern Keepers Association or a variety of places, all getting together and recognizing that each has his or her own vested interest in being there. But when coming to a point of beginning to take a look at sort of coming up with ways to address some of these density issues, one of the most effective approaches that I'm aware of took place in Tampa, in Florida, where they had a segment very similar to what it sounds like your caller was describing, where the alcohol outlet density was so great that pretty much every Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, it was just a melee down in this area of downtown Tampa. and through the formation of a campus community coalition, one that gave everybody at the table a voice and recognized the fact that everybody at the table may have had different reasons for being there, but they had the common denominator of concern about their community, we're able to actually take a look at reducing that density. So this issue of what can be done is actually one that is not beyond the grasp of even that resident who's living just off campus, or the shopkeeper, or the tavern owner, or the individual faculty member on campus. To the extent that there is a campus community coalition that's addressing some of these public policy issues. The last point that I would make on this, and by no means we could have a whole show just talking on this one issue, but the last one I would make in response to your caller is paying rather close attention to the impact that taxing has on the sale of alcohol. Now, obviously, the increase in the liquor excise tax is not going to have much of an impact on somebody who is alcohol dependent, if you will, the classic alcoholic drinker. He or she is going to drink even if the price goes up a nickel a drink or a dime a drink or what have you. But most individuals and the vast majority of even those high-risk collegiate drinkers are not alcohol-dependent drinkers to the extent that they are presented with opportunities to sort of take a step back and look at sort of this increase in cost and translate that into sort of CDs or jeans or car payments or whatever the alternative to the expenditure on alcohol is, can actually rethink some of their issues.
All right. I want to thank the call. Let's go to someone here in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
My question is based on my experience of 17 years teaching English at a local community college. When I first started, on various occasions, I would ask students what they were going to be doing over the weekend, male and female. And I got an assortment of replies, going home, going to a movie, out to dinner, whatever. And that was in the early 1990s, moving up to the later 1990s. And at that point, when I'd ask students, what's going to happen for you this weekend, mainly from white males, I'd get the reply, I'm going to get wasted, I'm going to get drunk, or whatever. And I was at first startled by the reply. But then I came to expect it. Interestingly, young women never said to me, if I asked the question, never mentioned drinking to me. I'm wondering if this kind of my experience is typical of the point at which binge drinking became very popular. And as a related question, that's something you haven't touched on, to what extent is binge drinking concentrated among white students as opposed to, let's say, blacks or Asians or other minority groups that you'd find on a campus?
Well, again, these are really excellent questions. First of all, with regards to the issues in teaching at a community college, there are some demographic differences between students who are going to community college and students who go to traditional four-year schools. One of the major differences being that we see in this day and age the preponderance of students going to four-year schools looking to live on campus, and that would be away from their family of origin, whereas even to this day we see a number of students who go to community college will oftentimes commute and will be commuting from home, where there's still the parental influence. Even if they are emancipated to the extent that they don't have curfews, etc., nonetheless they are going to be engaging in behaviors somewhat differently than if they were simply living in an off-campus apartment, things of this nature. I'm not sure that I can speak to the issue about what happened in the middle 90s. My hunch is that one of the things that is a factor is the sort of increase in the likelihood that individuals were engaging in drinking during high school. And about the same time, a concern that a number of my colleagues have had probably for the last 10 or 15 years has been the rather significant shift in focus of the kinds of issues that we find on college campus counseling centers now, as opposed to when I first started working in a college campus in the mid to late 80s. And that is that the, you know, sort of gone are the days where the mainstay of the college campus counseling center was sort of dealing with anxiety and roommate issues and relationship problems and work-study skills and time management and things of this nature. And most college campuses today are dealing with the full plethora of mental health issues that any clinic downtown would be addressing, personality disorders and mood disorders and depression and things of this nature. So we're finding, I think, that more individuals are actually making it through high school and able to go on to college as a result of therapy received, medications used, things of this nature. However, their continuation in therapy or their continuation in taking their medications may very well change after they find themselves on their own and at colleges. I think the issue that your caller brings up with regards to sort of taking a look at some racial demographics with regards to drinking is an interesting one. One of the things that we find from, and for me it was somewhat unexpected, but now that it's been pointed out to me, I've come to recognize that this makes perfect sense. But one of the lowest rates of high-risk drinking we find is among students of color. And to that end, when you begin to sort of take a look at who is it that engages in high-risk drinking, oftentimes we'll see individuals who are coming from various groups on campus. From a student organization point of view, we oftentimes see members of the Greek community or members of the athletic community engaging in high-risk behavior. And as far as the lower risk or the less dangerous drinking, oftentimes it's students of color. And it's also students who report being involved in community service work for 5 hours a month or more. I would caution your listeners, however, it's not that, you know, we can't say that a correlation means causation. In other words, because I'm volunteering 5 hours of community service work a month doesn't mean that I'm going to drink less. It may very well be that those who have a tendency to not drink are also attracted to sort of community service work. So again, another caller with several really interesting questions, most of which could sort of be teased out into a whole hour program as well.
Sure. Well, we're coming to the point here where we have maybe about 7 or 8 minutes left in this part of Focus. I have a couple of other callers. We'll see how many we can get in the time that remains. And also, for the benefit of anybody who might have just tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes, I will introduce again our guest, Robert Chapman. He is a clinical assistant professor of behavioral health counseling at Drexel University in Philadelphia. He is an experienced practitioner, trainer, program consultant in the area of alcohol and other drug services and has been working in this field now for more than 30 years. We're talking about drinking on college campuses by college students, and questions are welcome. Our next person up here should be, I believe, on line 3. And no, that person dropped off. Let's go to Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Two things. Since sexual repression is learned in the home, broadened through from upper childhood to later adolescence, and the relief that alcohol brings to those paradigms, I think is the, I'll sum it up with one statement that I heard when I worked in a local college as a laborer, get her drunk. And then it would flow from there. The other thing I would like to ask you about and your opinion on would be the legal age, I think, for males and females both to drink or to enter bars is 21. Well, the contradiction I see with young people of that age 21 and under, and the role of the federal government and the military service. You can join at 18, be trained and put into battle just like they're doing now around the world, and kill people before you are 21. And that seems to me to be the most utter contradiction, obscenity, or human social organization. And thank you, Dave. I'll bring on.
Sure. Well, that's a point I wanted to I'm glad the caller raised it, because it's something that I wanted to raise with you, in part because recently there has been some controversy generated by the fact that apparently some college administrators say, well, you know, maybe actually it would be a good thing for us to lower the drinking age, and that would make it perhaps easier to control the problem, or that we would have less of a problem if we made the legal age for drinking 18.
Well, you know, your caller is referring to, and you're speaking about it as well, is what's referred to as the Amethyst Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a group of college administrators who are suggesting that we have an open and frank dialogue around the minimum drinking age in the United States. I'm in favor of having this dialogue. I also happen to be in favor of leaving the drinking age where it currently is, but it's been since the early to mid-80s since we had this discussion, and consequently there's nobody the age of 26 or under who even remembers the last time this was discussed and has any idea as to why it is that 21 is 21. Many college students basically think that this is just an arbitrary decision that was made by a bunch of old people trying to cramp their social style, when in actuality the science is pretty specific with regards to the risks that are associated with the use of alcohol by individuals under the age of 21. So I think that it's really a good idea for us to have this dialogue and to have it frankly and to make sure that it's widespread. The issue about the apparent contradiction between whether somebody can go into the military at 18 and be trained and then go into battle but be denied the opportunity to drink is something of an apples and oranges kind of discussion, especially when you're taking a look at the impact that alcohol as a central nervous system drug has on the human body. And there's some very new, interesting research that's coming out talking about sort of the fact that the human brain isn't done developing until one is in their early 20s, and some suggest as old as 25. And the very last parts of the brain that are essentially coming online are the frontal lobes, and that's where the sight or the seat, if you will, of reason and judgment and things of this nature are considered. So that, if anything, I think the argument would be, do we want to draft individuals or do we want to have people going into battle at the age of 18, rather than we should lower the drinking age to 18 because they're able to go into the military. Again, we could go on in this, but I know you've got some other callers, David.
Well, we're down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left, and literally maybe about one and a half. Just to finish up, I'm sure that universities, because they're educational institutions, their impulse is, well, this is an educational issue, that is educating students to think about how it is they drink and the consequences. And I guess I just wonder, at last here, we can talk a little bit about what do you think universities have done successfully to educate students to get them to think about drinking, and also to create a more positive drinking culture, if such a thing can be said to exist.
Sure. This would make a great follow-up program for some time in the future. There are a number of things that have happened over the last 10 or 12 years that I think are just really exciting and hold great promise for the future. The first of these is, as I had alluded to earlier, this whole collection of what are referred to as environmental management strategies. And these have been very effectively implemented by colleges and universities as a way of beginning to sort of take this issue seriously and to act on it instead instead of react to it. So gone are the keg parties in the lounge on the floor for students as a way of celebrating and so on and so forth. And resident assistants are being trained specifically. We're taking a look at the role of advertising in the form of the local beer distributor who pays for the billboard in the sports arena and so on and so forth, and alcohol availability and a whole host of issues. So environmental management strategies are very effective and very promising. The other is a whole approach to dealing with high-risk use on a one-on-one basis. There's a program that's coming out of the University of Washington called Brief Alcohol Screening and Intervention for College Students. It's referred to as BASICS, which has shown that in as little as 2 interviews, individuals can come to a point where they can take a step back, look at the big picture, recognize the risk associated with their drinking, and then modify that behavior. And we're seeing this being shown in empirical study after empirical study. So there are many resources that are available. And I sometimes, when I speak, sort of echo Charles Dickens' opening to A Tale of Two Cities. It was the worst of times, which we've spent the majority of time talking about in this program, but it's also the best of times. Mm-hmm. And that we've got tools now that we've never had before that show great promise.
Well, there we have to leave it. Our guest is Robert Chapin. He is a clinical assistant professor of behavioral health counseling at Drexel University in Philadelphia. If you'd like to look at some of his writing on this subject, you might go to his website, robertchapman.net. And Dr. Chapman, thanks very much.
You're quite welcome, David. I appreciate it.